Someone asked me the other day about Zardoz. How did you persuade Sean Connery to wear a wedding dress?
Right.
In the film.
Right.
And then someone said to me, well, how did you persuade those actors in Deliverance to go down those cataracts and rapids? And I said, well, it's very easy. What you do is you say to the actors, right, you see that those rapids there? You get into the canoes and you go down. And you make it sound as though it's the most ordinary thing in the world. You know? And so I say, Sean, in this scene you wear a wedding dress, okay? It's over here. Go and put it on. Brooks, no argument, you know. I walk away, and he's left there holding up a wedding dress. You
Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 275 with legendary director John Borman. His newest film, it's called Queen and Country, and it's currently playing at Film Forum in New York City, and I imagine it will be out in a number of other cities over the coming weeks and months. However, everybody will eventually see this movie. I mean, this is a great, great filmmaker who has made more hit films than just about any other filmmaker. He's been around a long time. But Queen of Country is currently going into its second week at the Film Forum. It will be there through Tuesday, March the 3rd. Again, a Film Forum, which is on West Houston Street, just west of 6th Avenue in New York City. Please do go see it. It is a beautiful film. If you're old enough to remember when Hope and Glory came out, this picks up the story, I think, a mere 8 years later, as you'll hear. You'll hear a lot of things. We touch upon a number of his hit films. We talk about, in some form or fashion, Deliverance, of course, Lee Marvin, who is in two different films of John Borman's. Lee Marvin was in two films by John Borman, those two being Point Blank and Hell in the Pacific. We talk about Hell in the Pacific. We talk about Leo, the Last, which is with Marcello Mastroianni. We talk about Zardoz, that cult underground film that he made with Sean Connery, who is running around in a skirt and a ponytail. And this was just after his Bond movies. This was just after he finished making those Bond movies and he did Zardoz. Believe it or not, Connery found it hard to get work. And I don't know if this helped him, but I guess he figured it out. What else did we talk about? So much more. I don't need to go into it because you can just listen to this. This is like, for a jerk like me, this is really humbling to just get to the point where I can sit with him. I was listening to Borman on Leonard Lopate show, which was helpful. Can think of things to talk about. But he was on there for 20 minutes. And that's the nature of that, of doing that kind of show. I couldn't do Film Wax Radio like I do it now, on the radio. I'd have to change the format. But I got like an hour with Borman. So thank you for everybody at the BBC America, especially Debs over there. Debs, who helped to hook me up with John and for such a nice long conversation. And you really learn a lot about the guy, which you're not going to hear anywhere else. I can just tell you that. So for those of you who may be less familiar with the career of John Borman, I, of course, just named a handful of his films, but I left out quite a few, including he did a bunch of TV and documentaries before he got started as sort of a mainstream, big-budget Hollywood. And, but how he described it was that he actually was kind of making films independently all along. It's just, he managed to shoot all over the world and then just deliver his films to Hollywood and enjoy their money they financed him with. But he started off, if you can believe it, in 1967. So it hasn't even been 50 years, but he started in 1967 with Point Blank. And that was his first mainstream feature film. He's made so many hit films, and the films are bigger than his reputation and his name. But he started in roughly 1965 in terms of making mainstream feature films. I have not seen this one. It's called Having a Wild Weekend. But shortly after that, he went and he made Point Blank in 1967 with Lee Marvin. And then he got together with Lee Marvin again the next year and made Hell in the Pacific with Toshirô Mifune, and then went on to make a string of big films. Most of them hits, not every single one of them, but most of them are hits. Just to go through some of the other films. Yes, he made Leo the Last in 1970, went on to Deliverance in 72, Zardoz in 74. Okay, he made The Exorcist II, The Heretic in 1977. Not the greatest film, but he rebounded with Excalibur and his second collaboration with Sean Connery. And that was 1981. Went on to make The Emerald Forest with Meg Foster and Powers Booth, Hope and Glory in 1987. And then to skip ahead, Beyond Rangoon and The Tailor of Panama, 2001. And then just to get us closer up to date, he made Queen and Country, which is currently, again, out in the Film Forum right now. So that is the career of John Borman in a nutshell. I just want to tell you, this was, again, one of my favorite podcasts to do. And thank you for, again, at BBC America. Thank you, Betty Kaplan, for helping me out. And most of all, thanks, John Borman, for sitting with me and listening to my questions for that hour. Right now, let's go into the conversation with John Borman, and we'll be back afterwards.
It was 1952. I was waiting to be called up to serve 2 years conscription in the army.
They'll have their work cut out, making a soldier of you, pipsqueak.
I did my basic training with these boys.
We're locked in.
It's only for 2 years. This could be the beginning of a
beautiful friendship.
Order!
As soon as you taught me how to do it, I'm going to kill them.
What a pitiful bunch.
We lived together in a barrack room, and the more they brutalized us and broke us down, the closer we got.
You are all about to be posted to Korea. Which is no laughing matter, I can assure you.
Arses! A-R-S-E-S! Let's find some girls. Forget the unattainable and take what's on offer. We're in.
Why are you not saluting the officer? Excuse saluting, sir. Hernia.
So, well, I'll be talking about like this. And
yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's
how's
perfect.
That sound?
Sounds really good.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Well, it's very nice to meet you.
And you.
And thanks for making time in the schedule. And doing this, it's such
pleasure.
I don't get as many opportunities to talk to people with such an illustrious long career, and so it's a little bit intimidating too, but it's also really gratifying to be able to talk about with somebody who's been doing it for as long as you have. Well, let's get out of the way right away. Queen and Country, your new feature, which is a sequel to Hope and Glory.
Yeah.
And it's out right now in New York City at the Film Forum. Has it played already in let's say the UK or Europe at all?
It's the only other country it's opened in so far is France. We opened in France on the 7th of January, which was the day of the terrorist attack.
The Charlie Hebdo.
It was a bit of a disaster in the sense that nobody went to the cinema to see anything that day or that week.
Yeah.
And so anyway, picked up all right in the following week.
And they do go. So for French people not to show up at a John Borman movie means something really horrific had to have happened, because those people love their movies.
Yeah, I do pretty well over there.
I bet you do. No, I mean,
and I think, you know, this marvelous guy, Pierre Rission, who did the subtitles, and I'm watching it with a French audience. I think he must have improved on the dialogue, because they were laughing much more about the subtitles than they were with the dialogue.
Right, and I'm sure the majority of people who are seeing the movie probably could follow the movie, or mostly without even subtitles, but less work involved in that way, so they can
With digital projection, you can actually on the same. You can have the original version with subtitles and the dub version on the same thing. So you can show the original version in the afternoon and the dub version in the evening. It's fantastic.
Yeah, but nobody's really dubbing anymore, right? You mean just without subtitles?
Dubbing is great. I love it.
You're just going to start a new trend. Finally, dubbing is coming back. I bet they can actually now probably digitally make it look a lot more like people are actually speaking whatever language.
Yeah.
The whole gamut of languages.
But it's, you know, if you if you embrace it,
yes.
And I often, whenever I can, I go and supervise the dub version, and they always try to make it as exactly as close as possible to the original. But I always say to them, no, let's make another movie here. You know, we can do all kinds of things.
Right.
It's fun. And especially, you know, you've finished the film and probably months before, and you're quite happy to do a kind of remake in Italian.
Yes. Yeah. No, I understand it. Like yeah. that, because it's sort of like a reboot to your creative approach to this movie you've been working on for the last however many years.
Yeah.
You know,
I was once in Rome doing a dub of one of my films.
Lucio, tell your mother you love her. You know, it's that kind of.
There was this little tiny fat guy sitting in the corner looking very depressed. And I said, what's wrong with him?
Yeah.
And they said, well, he's John Wayne, and John Wayne had just died.
Oh. So that's funny. Yeah, he's out of work.
Yeah.
So, speaking of having fun, though, I remember when Hope and Glory came out. I was a young guy. I was in my, probably, 87? Did it come out in the States anyway?
Yeah.
It was 87? I just loved that movie so much, and I went back to it a second time alone, and then I started to bring... I saw it three times, I think, at least, in the movie theater. Well, there was no other option, really.
Right.
But because... I just loved it so much. And part of it was, in effect, why it stands out is that I would never gone to see a war film before where the people seemed to be having so much fun or finding the joy. Hmm. And it was just such a new way of telling that story. Obviously, it was autobiographical to a great extent. But what inspired you to take that approach to it?
It was always such a vivid time as a child, you know. And so I thought, you know, I'd tried to make it like seen through the eyes of a 7 or 8 year old boy. And although there were times that were which were, you know, fearful, for the most part it was terrific. You know, often the schools were closed because of bombs dropping and things, and so got off school, and and all the fathers were away. It was a land of women, which I showed in the film.
Yes, you did.
And men were all off in the army. Women were running things and running wild to some extent, too, because there was this attitude that we better get on with having some fun because, you know, we might be dead tomorrow. That attitude was around. So I thought that had never been depicted on film, and so that's what I try to do.
Think they can come over here and take all women? Isn't that your sister, Owen?
Are you strong enough for another shot? You're going to be a grandma.
Hello, Grandma!
I think you hit him, Grandpa. He was slipping when he ran off.
I taught him well, and now he turns it against me.
Well done.
Rowan! It was a straight bomb! Thank you, Adolf!
And how do you think it came out? Was it an authentic version of your childhood in the end? Do you feel like that was it, or feel it was romanticized?
Yeah, I started off by just writing down all the things I could remember, the vivid things I could remember about the time, that time. And, you know, and then I sort of started to dramatize it out of those incidents. And it was, in fact, my first title for the film was Shrapnel and Other Fragments, and so which give you an idea of how fragmented it was. And shrapnel was, of course, a big thing.
Sure.
All the we've all had shrapnel collections of bomb fragments and shell fragments.
Yeah.
And we used to go out in the morning, and often you would pick up a fragment of a bomb, and it would be hot.
Still hot.
Still hot, yeah. And you'd burn your fingers on it.
Yeah.
I have one of the best collections.
That was my next question. if you still had the collection of shrapnel?
No, I don't.
Oh, what happened to it?
No, I don't have any, because eventually, as you saw in the film,
yes,
our house was destroyed.
Oh, right.
And my collection of lead soldiers and shrapnel all went up in flames, as it did everything else. And at that time, not only food was rationed, but also clothing was rationed. So we had what we stood up in, and that was it. And it took 3 months to get emergency clothing coupons.
Oh, jeez.
So,
wow. So you relied on, obviously, friends, families, donations, charity, to a great degree at the very beginning.
Friends There was always these exchanges that you could go to, and particularly with children. So you could take as your kids grew up a bit, you took the clothes to the exchange, and you got some clothes that were a bit bigger,
right.
And you gave in the ones that you no longer fitted your child, and mm-hmm. So it was, and the curious thing was that I remember. The feeling I had as a child when the house was burning was that I felt a feeling of lightness,
mm-hmm.
and that everything, all possessions were gone. And from that moment, I've never owned anything that I couldn't
stand to lose.
Worry about losing.
Mm.
And I've never collected anything. And, I'm being encouraged to put my archive together. And so I don't have very much, really. I don't, because, they said, well, your scripts would be very important. And I said, well, I throw them away.
Oh, my goodness.
Because,
wow.
I mean, once the script has done its job, once you've made the film...
Mm-hmm. It's true, but yeah, you don't have that mentality going into all that. So you're not going to be on any episode of Hoarders anytime soon. We know that much. You know these reality TV shows that where people can't even navigate their own homes because they don't throw anything out.
Yeah.
So it's a big issue apparently. So the film also depicts that, and that's liberating. That's got to be liberating, right? Because by the way, your films, of which I haven't counted how many features, but there's got to be a good 25, I guess, you've made. Maybe the number of feature films you've made.
Not about 17, actually.
Okay, so I was a little rather.
That'd be very lazy.
You leave that behind. That's a lot right there. That's quite a collection that you don't have to, and you don't have to worry about storing it in your.
But those,
losing it because it's out there forever.
But it's only rather accidentally. Is that accidental that films survive? After all, 90% of the early silent films have all disappeared, because at that time, people didn't think of something to save. You made them, you showed them, you threw them away.
Right. Yeah.
Because it was rather like the only. Experience people had before films was the theater, where you put on a play and then everybody went home. And so this notion of
film preservation
was quite a recent idea. And of course, I think there's an awful lot of films that don't deserve to be preserved.
You haven't made any of those, so that's nothing to we have to worry about. We were talking about Queen and Country, which is also a sequel. Did you specifically want to make something perceived as a sequel, or were you feeling nostalgic and wanted to tell this next chapter?
Well,
the Queen and Country takes place 10 years later.
No, 8 years later, really.
By the end of the war,
really, the boy was like 10 years old, and then at 18 have to go in the army. So, you know, after the destruction of our house and the Blitz, we'd moved to the river at Shepperton, and we were living in this kind of dreamlike idyll of life on the river. Yeah. And when 8 years later, we find the boy is still there, and he's still in this kind of dream, and then he's awoken rudely by the nastiness of the army.
Right, a bit of adulthood. It sort of snuck up on him, right? Mm. The boy's name is Bill?
Is what?
The boy's name? I'm sorry, of Hope and Glory and now Queen and Country. Is it Bill? Yeah, it is Bill, right? Little Bill?
Yes.
Okay. And he's conscripted into the army, I guess you could say?
Everybody was at 18.
Yeah.
Because, it was only 5 years or so after the war.
Right.
And and Britain still had garrisons all over the world. It had to be manned. And after the war, all the soldiers were demobbed. They were and went back into civilian life. And they needed people. They needed them. There were garrisons in the Suez, in Kenya, in Germany, all over. What's interesting about that period is that you had this hangover after the war. England was a very bleak kind of place. But the older generation were hanging on to the notions of empire,
mm-hmm.
and Imperial Britain. And Britain was the biggest empire ever known.
How much of the globe did they have their imprint on? Like, it was
2/5 of the Earth's surface was British.
Yeah.
And within a few years, mm-hmm. it was all gone. And England became a small island off the coast of Europe.
Right.
And this was a momentous change, and it was happening. Yeah. So in the film, you have the young guys who realize that all that is over, and you have the older ones who are still hanging on to the notion. And so it was a point of tremendous change. Within a few years, the empire was gone. And then England changed. When you a few years later, you had the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the art scene. Everything completely changed.
And then pop culture-wise, England was again 2/5 of the globe because of the Beatles and the Stones.
Swinging
and the
60s.
That's right.
We have the swinging 60s and the miniskirt.
Well, God, your timing was good. You lucky devil. That's another podcast episode. We're going to have to talk about your life. He looks about 30 years younger, just talking about the swinging 60s again.
Yeah.
He's only 16. I'm in the swinging.
How much of this had an impact on you? We see in Hope and Glory, Bill is taking photographs, so already there's there's an interest with images. It leads right up to through Queen of Country, where by the end of that, he's a budding filmmaker, right?
Yeah, well, I think that in that bleak time, I think the movies, going to the movies, and particularly watching American movies, was, you know, what kept us going. America was this incredibly glamorous place.
Yeah,
and these movies were coming out, and we hung on to that. And in the film, there are references to the movies that opened at that time. You know, during the time when I was in the army. Like Sunset Boulevard and
right, so American cinema. So you were exporting. Britain was exporting the music at that point. Let's face it; they had the best music coming out of. This was even before that. You're saying
Of course. So, that time, you know,
this is the '40s you're talking about.
David Lean was making movies and Michael Powell,
right,
and they were really. Part of the change that was happening.
And when did you become interested in Hollywood, I guess, and making that transition professionally? Because how many films did you make in the UK before you went to America and started to work as a director for hire or on your own scripts?
So when I came out of the army after my 2 years, and, you know, I wanted to be involved in filmmaking, and I went I trained then as a film editor, and I was very happy to. I've spent my life as a film editor. I loved it, doing it,
mm-hmm.
and I was making documentaries and cutting them, and then. I was working for the BBC, and one day, they asked me to go out and direct one of these documentaries because the director didn't turn up.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out and directed it, and
came
back and cut it, and then I started doing that and making longer and bigger documentaries. And I was quite happy doing that. And, my whole career is a series of accidents, really. I never thought I wanted to be a film director. In fact, my ambition originally was to be, you know what a clapper loader is?
Oh, clapper loader. Well, I'm going to screw it up. I want to say it's the clapboard guy, but that's not what it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, so he does the clapperboard.
Okay.
And he also loads the camera.
Oh, very good.
So he's called.
You really are lazy.
A clapper loader. And I thought that was the
coolest job.
Ultimate job. I applied mm-hmm. to all the studios to be a clapper loader, and they all turned me down. And so I then went in and started editing.
Yeah.
And working with the BBC. And then I made longer and longer documentaries and more ambitious ones, and they sort of had reputation. And then I got bored with the limitations of documentary, and I started to dramatize documentaries. And I started making drama films for the BBC, for the television. And so career just kind of grew
naturally and transitioned.
I never had this idea that one day I'll be a film director. It just happened. Then I started getting offers to direct features. So
was this around the time of around the time you started to make features, where like the Lindsay Andersons making Lester and.
But I think the BBC at that time, BBC Television, run by a man called Hugh Weldon, who was a mentor to many. Including Ken Russell and John Schlesinger. And he had this theory that television was mostly repetition and you needed workhorses to do these weekly programs and things. And then you needed events. So we were a group, ones I mentioned, who were given more resources and time to do bigger projects. And I was chosen as one of those, and there we are.
It's funny you mentioned the documentaries, because I was feeling like Open Glory really had a kind of a documentary feel to it. The Blitz going on behind in the backdrop, and it was really had a sense of that. While we're watching Little Bill and his friends running around the shell of what was once their neighborhood, but maybe behind them are all these incredible real life events taking place,
Yes.
And so there was a sense of documentary feel to that, as well as to Queen of
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Indeed. And if you look at some of the other films, it's there too. Did your work in documentary, did it follow you through into wanting to make films with a social theme to it? One that comes quickly to mind is Leo the Last, which has been one of your lesser known films, and now with this wonderful film forum retrospective, of course, have rediscovered. I watched it. I had not been familiar. I was like, this is just an incredible, charming film, Leo the Last. I loved it.
One of the big influences on me was in London, the National Film Theatre opened when I was 17, which was, I think, in 1950, I think it was. And they showed at that time all the great silent movies.
Yes.
And I became absolutely besotted with them. If you mentioned Leo the Last, where Mastroianni is this privileged fellow living in the big house, and he watches on his the slum dwellers in the street,
mm-hmm.
and through his binoculars or his telescope, and so a lot of it is seen through his lens,
and it's
all silent because you can't hear what they're saying or anything, and so the whole story. I was able to use the techniques of silent cinema to tell story without dialogue.
Right. Yeah. So what's going on is you're with his perspective, right? We're looking through his monocle or whatever, yeah, the lens of his sight, and then because we can't hear what's going on, down the block, what he's looking at.
That's
either.
Right.
So right. So it is his close. And then you've got Mastroianni's face and his his acting, which is almost like a silent screen actor. Right.
Yes.
In that same
he's
sad,
so expressive.
Yeah, it's a beautiful performance you got from it. It's a very beautiful performance. I'm glad I finally had the opportunity to see that film. And it was also I don't think there was a lot of films going on like that at the time, like where kind of taking a look at underprivileged, struggling financially
well, it was
community.
At that time, after the war, a lot of there was a big influx of West Indians came into Britain, and they mostly settled up there in Notting Hill Gate district of London, and that's where I shot the film. I had this possibility that there was a whole street that was going to be demolished.
Right.
And I was able to take over the whole street and paint the street black and the houses black, everything black, and build a facade of a grand house at the end of the street, which Mastroianni is. And
his mansion,
and it was a story of which, in a way, Zardoz was an extension of that story between the separation between the rich and the poor, and how the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
To you, his chosen ones, the gun is good.
The gun is good!
Go forth and kill.
Who came here in the stone head?
I don't know.
It is the only path and passage into the vortex. You will show me how you come to be here. Tell me everything.
My name is Zed. For Zardoz, I am an exterminator.
Tell the story behind the title. It's an interesting, just a little bit of information, how you came up with the title for Zardoz.
Well, the title is explained in the film, which is that it's the brutals on the outside are controlled by this flying head, which is rather like, so Zardoz is this kind of god,
right?
And he controls these people, and it's based on. So Sean Connery discovers this library, and discovers this book, The Wizard of Oz, and he sees it's
no problem,
and he sees that if you the last wizard Zard Oz.
Mm-hmm.
Wizard of Oz, and he realizes that they've been tricked. So he figures it out, and that's how the title comes from. Because, like the figure in Wizard of Oz who, with his big voice,
right,
frightens people.
Yeah, a big head, too, yeah, right? Isn't there, like in the Wizard of Oz, within there a big head? Yeah, it's another little film that people are rediscovering Zardoz, right? Because it's kind of been not one of your better known films, but it seems I see come up. There seems to be a lot, a kind of a following of people who really dig that movie, right? And was that your first time working with Sean Connery?
Mm-hmm.
It was very good. Who can't do a Sean Connery impression? I don't know, but he's fantastic. And you shoot him in that, don't do, do you? Are you? Is it my mis? Am I wrong, or is there a moment now? See, I'm coming like the fan.
Well, Sean,
I'm now just asking, you know fan questions. Which
Sean
is,
had just finished doing the Bond,
right? And he couldn't get hired.
And no, people didn't want to employ him because he was so associated with the Bond films that they didn't want to hire him really, and so. I got him to do this really cheap Zardoz.
Yeah. I listened to your commentary. I don't know if you remember how much of it. That's why I was listening to your audio commentary on the DVD.
On what?
On Zardoz. I rented it.
I don't remember doing that. But
yes, I watched it all the way through because I had not seen it also. And then I watched it a second time. You must be thinking, this guy, how does he have so much time on sins? I don't know. But you do the audio commentary by yourself, only you, through the entire thing. And, you know, you kind of just tell anecdotes about the film. Like, for instance, how...
Did I talk about the way I got the money?
No, you probably did. I don't remember. Only certain things that do I remember. But go ahead. How did you get the money?
Well, my agent at the time was David Beagleman.
Yes.
He was a great agent. And he was so sincere that it was almost real.
It's funny. Yeah.
And so he said to me, look, you're never going to get the money for this. If it goes through the systems, of the studio systems, you know,
right.
we've got to find a way of doing this. So he went to Fox and said, they've just got new management. He said, look, here's the deal. You send your man over to London. He has 2 hours to read the script. Mm-hmm. And it's a yes or no. You have no approvals. And it's a negative pickup. In other words, $1 million annual for. Borman makes the film. He delivers you the film. You give him $1 million. Mm-hmm. That's the deal.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy comes over. And I was so nervous about it. But David was saying, don't worry. Don't worry. So the guy goes into the office and he has the script there, and they locked him in the office, and he has 2 hours, and we're waiting outside. We had lunch, and then we came back and we wait outside, and door opens finally, and he's standing there and he's holding the script, and his hand is shaking,
mm-hmm.
and the leaves are fluttering with mm-hmm. the script. And he looks wild-eyed, and he's got to make this decision. And David goes out to him and offers his hand and says, congratulations. He never had a chance to say yes or no. David just congratulated him, and that was it.
That's a good approach.
Some of those agents were great.
Yes.
Unfortunately, he shot himself.
Beagleman.
David did.
Wasn't he a part of that? He was part of a big...
He was a big gambler.
Right.
And he got into debt.
Yeah, okay. Mm. And that was the cause of it? Because wasn't he also involved in some sort of controversy at some point?
Well,
he ended up being a studio executive.
Columbia for a bit.
And there was a scam or something.
He wrote checks to himself, I think.
Oh, yeah, that'll happen. Yeah. You're not supposed to do that. Write that down. there was a book about it, a very famous bestseller, and I was trying to remember. Yeah, exactly, Debs. It's also working with Sean Connery, making all sorts of clumsy transitions and connections, but then you did make a bunch of a number of very masculine films, and I that's just my way of putting it, like... Maybe I'm checkerboarding a little bit.
You were trying to do an impersonation of Sean Connery.
I was trying.
I said to Sean once, do you ever think of doing a different accent, you know? He said, if I didn't talk the way I talk, I wouldn't know who the hell I am. And he won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in a film where he played an Irish cop with a Scots accent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just as well. Apparently the Academy voters couldn't tell the difference between Scots or an Irish accent.
Yeah. And you live in Ireland, right? Don't you? Mm-hmm. You live in Ireland, right?
I do.
Yeah. Why do you live in Ireland? What was the decision? And how long have you been living in Ireland?
45 years.
On a whim kind of thing? No.
Yeah.
No. Why? Well, you were raised, obviously, in the UK. What was the reason you ended up living in Ireland?
It was an accident, really. I was there doing post-production on Leo the Last because there was all the post-production houses in London were full up. So we went to Ireland and Ardmore Studios. And it was a beautiful summer, and I thought we might go to buy a cottage for holidays. And I loved it, the landscape. And then one day I showed this house, and I went to it was an auction, and I wandered into this auction because this house is being auctioned, and I had this out-of-body experience, and I was kind of looking down at the auction. There were two people were bidding for it, and one of them appeared to be me. And then people were congratulating me, and I had bought this, not a cottage, but a big house, you know, and I hadn't even been inside it.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I didn't know anything about it. And so in the kind of... I'd spent so much money on it, it became our house by default. And I've been pouring money into it ever since, and I'm too poor to leave.
I understand. We're actually in his foyer at the moment recording this. I've never been to Ireland myself. It's one of those places I am dying to go to. Now I know where I can stay.
Its great virtue was for me at the time was it was a long way from Hollywood.
Right.
And, you know, I was going crazy there. I loved it, but at the same time, it was somehow depleting the spirit.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
So
and that was around Leo the Last. I don't have my filmography in front of me.
You know, I have a little river runs through it.
Uh-huh.
And I've always, you know, had the need to be near a river and in amongst trees, and so that's why
that was. And so that you did see from the outside, obviously. So maybe that was.
Yeah.
So maybe it reminded you of that house on the Thames. Was it the Thames?
Yes, to some extent, it's true. Yeah.
Maybe.
And I plant trees. You know, I'm passionate about trees. And in the span of 45 years that I've lived there, you know, I've seen trees grow up, and I've outlived some of them. So I live in the span of trees, and that suits me very well.
You're not going to have anybody arguing about trees. It's not that controversial a subject. So I'm right there with you. I love trees as well. I do love trees.
Do you know, one thing, you know, I know a little bit about them, having studied them for many, many years.
Okay.
Is that one of the side effects of pollution and the fact that more and more carbon dioxide is put into the air, is trees are growing faster because trees feed on carbon dioxide.
Right.
That's what they're built on, carbon dioxide. So there's so much more of it around. They're shooting up.
Right. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Another thing, you know, Dutch elm disease, which wiped out all the elms, sadly, changed the landscape of Britain. And this forester, a friend of mine, he planted a lot of elms alongside the motorways, and these elms flourished because the pollution coated them and protected them from the disease.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So why don't we learn from this?
I got some of these. I planted them on my grounds, and I don't have any pollution.
No.
So they died.
I understand. Yeah. Something to be learned from there. It was one of those happy accidents in a way.
Yes.
Where, you know, then they can apply it to like the...
But strange things happen, you know.
Right, yeah. But it takes the more evolved sort to figure out, let's learn from this and use it, harness it, you know,
yeah,
for better reason, for better purposes. Well, there were a lot of trees in Deliverance. That was a terrible transition. Yeah, really. That was about the worst one yet I've ever been. But I definitely can't leave without not talking about Deliverance and Point Blank and a couple of these other very American films. So these are real Hollywood films. Were they? I mean,
first of all, Deliverance, I never went anywhere near Hollywood. But Deliverance, I was already living in Ireland.
Okay, right.
And I went straight to South Carolina and Georgia to make the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to Ireland to edit it. And so I bypassed.
Yeah, Hollywood. So the money came from Hollywood.
Oh, it did, yeah.
Right? So, yeah. But you didn't have...
It came from Warner's at the time when John Calley was running things there.
You liked him.
He was great. He was great. He never gave me a note. Sat down and chatted about it for a bit. He said, okay, go and write the script. And I gave him the script. He said, that seems okay.
Yeah.
Off you go. It's very different now.
And that was the first time working with John Voight, right, for you and Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
Ronnie Cox and Ned Beatty, of course. Did all those guys get along well? Did they know each other? Maybe
through beforehand? No, not at all.
That was probably to your advantage.
Yeah, I mean, people sometimes ask me, you know, who was the most difficult actor I worked with?
Why would they ask that? But go ahead. Who was? Or what was your answer to that?
I've never had any difficulties with actors. And, you know, if all actors need is they need to feel safe. They need to feel that you're looking after them. And as long as you communicate what you want and where it's going, it's always a wonderful experience with actors. I always love it.
You like them?
Yeah, I do. And I think they're very courageous to stand up in front of a camera and, you know, express emotion, especially take risks, take chances. You know, a lot of actors will, if they're in a situation which is unstable or fractious, they will, they'll fall back on what I call defensive acting, which is that you say, well, I know how to get through this scene, you know, rather than I'm going to take risks, I'm going to try something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've had nothing but joy with actors. I mean, Voight, I made two films with Voight, Deliverance and The General.
The General, right.
And I've had the privilege of working with actors like Mastroianni, and Lee Marvin was, of course, I think, the greatest film actor I ever worked with.
I'm so glad you brought Lee Marvin up, because for whatever reason, you know, he was just one of those John Wayne types, or this is something I picked up incorrectly. And when I was introduced a number of years ago to Point Blank and watched that, I said, what have I been missing? And then because of the last few weeks I knew that I was sitting with you, I went and I found Hell in the Pacific. And I watched that, and I was like, "Why? How is it possible? I have not seen this film before. It was amazing." I said, "This is such a great Lee Marvin is such a great actor. Why did I not reject him? But I kind of just reduced his whole style. But I was really wrong."
Well, we were talking about silent films, and when I made Hell in the Pacific about these two men, Lee Marvin and Toshirô Mifune, on this tiny island, washed up on this tiny island. Without a common language, and this was like making a silent movie. I mean, you had sound effects, and of course they shouted and did things, but fundamentally it was a silent movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to draw on all my experience of watching and studying silent films
mm-hmm.
in making that one.
Yeah, that's true. That was another silent film. Very true. That's a great pairing. Obviously, you're the final decider of casting in your films, I'm assuming in almost every case. But did you just see those two actors together, that they would have a great rapport and great chemistry, Mifune and...
Well, this is...
And Lee Marvin?
Yeah, I mean, there was a short story it was based on, and Lee was very anxious to work with Mifune. He admired him enormously.
Oh, really? Okay.
And they got on very well. And unfortunately, I didn't get on very well with Mifune. It was a long story. I don't want to go into it. It's too painful. But
interesting.
It was tough.
But he was wrong and you were right. That much you can say.
No, well, it was. When I was writing the script, I had two writers, an American writer and a Japanese writer called Shobu Hashimoto, who worked a lot with Kurosawa. And he at one point, he was a gambler and he wanted to go off to Vegas. And he said, could he go off and do a draft on his own? And he went off and he did his drafts. And he didn't alter any of the scenes at all. He just altered the character of Mifune, and he made him into a kind of buffoon, rather like it was okay. In The Seven Samurai. And, you know, we translated it, and I said, oh, no, that's not, that's completely out wrong. And whether malignantly or accidentally, he gave that version to Mifune. So when we started shooting... I had a Japanese crew, and I had to constantly correct Mifune, which was a loss, huge loss of face for him to be corrected.
In front of the crew,
and that he was doing the wrong. And he refused to change, you know. He just kept doing it the same way. I asked him to change. He wouldn't, and I had to stop shooting, go back to the ship. We were living on a ship, and argue for hours. And it went on all like that.
It doesn't show in the film. It's a really
Eventually, we got behind, and the producers turned up, and I had an accident on the reef, and I got a coral poisoning in my knee, and
oh dear.
I was in fever, and I couldn't work, and so they went to Mifune and said, be pleased to hear that we're going to replace Borman because, you know, he's sick and you don't get on and you're getting far behind, so we're going to replace him. And Mifune said, I couldn't agree to that. Why not? He said, because we went to the tea house in Tokyo and I agreed to do the film with him. It's a matter of honor. And the producer said to him, hey, listen, this is Hollywood. Honor doesn't come into it.
Just ask David Begelman.
So anyway, yeah. He wouldn't budge. So
there's that.
I went back and I thought, now we're going to be pals, you know, but it went right, on exactly the same way.
Understood.
The argument just continued on.
Right.
And the only codicil to this story was that he opened a restaurant in Munich called Mifune, and you might imagine it was also a Japanese restaurant. And I went in there with two or three people to have dinner, and when I asked for the check, they said there's no charge, because Mifune had left a list of people, if they came in, they didn't have to pay. Which I interpret as a kind of apology.
That's a good way to interpret that.
Has this got anything to do with anything?
Is this exactly. No. Yeah. Absolutely, John. Because I think a lot of people. I think the people that listen to this thing that I do are really interested in both what goes on behind.
Yeah.
What's going on in your mind and how your journey on a very practical level, because they can learn from that, because a lot of filmmakers I think listen to the show, but on the other hand they also I think are geeks, you know, like nerds around actors and filmmakers and things like that. So those types of stories really
you must know that. You're asking about actors.
Yeah.
Someone asked me the other day, about Zardoz. How did you persuade Sean Connery to wear a wedding dress?
Right.
In the film.
Right.
And then someone said to me, well, how did you persuade those actors in Deliverance to go down those cataracts and rapids? And I said, well, it's very easy. What you do is you say to the actors, right, you see that those rapids there? You get into the canoes and you go down. And you make it sound as though it's the most ordinary thing in the world. You know? And so I say, Sean, in this scene you wear a wedding dress, okay? It's over here. Go and put it on. Brooks, no argument, you know. I walk away, and he's left there with a dresser holding up a wedding dress.
He should be lucky because a lot of those extras, they had things, their leggings and stuff sprayed on, right? Because you said because the budget wasn't great. Let's put it that way. It wasn't a huge budget on that film. So.
Sean is the archetypal tight Scotsman. You
right,
know.
Of course.
When we started the film, he came to me and said, John, in my contract, I've got a car and a driver, right? And I said, yeah. He said, I'll drive myself and I'll split it with you. And he was
if you only knew what.
And then he stayed in my house, you know. And he stayed in my house and we were preparing the film. And so I said, well, you know, you're comfortable here. You might as well just stay on while we're shooting. And he said, if I do that, I'll pay my way. All right. So at the end of the week, he gives my wife an envelope with £7 in it. Now, you know, he was drinking, you know, a couple of bottles of scotch every week alone, you know, which was, I mean, £7 was apparently what he would pay when he was on the touring company of South Pacific. £7 was what he paid to a landlady for his room, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's what his idea of rent was. He had a sense of humor, O'Connery, obviously. He liked to have fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Queen of Country is, again, we're going to week two of Queen of Country, which is your newest film. And potentially, is this, you don't have plans to make more? I don't want to get into this territory necessarily, but
I announced this is my last film, and the last shot of the film is of an amateur camera wind up that stops, and that was my little metaphor for ending the end of my career. But I'm being encouraged to do another one. I don't know whether I will.
All right. No.
It's, you know.
No pressure.
Clint Eastwood is 3 years older than me. I thought I did probably
and made
well.
His biggest successful film this year.
I know, yeah. Mm-hmm. I hated it. Anyway.
I'm trying to get him on the show, so it easy does it. Yeah. Well, I certainly understand. I mean, you've done your bit, but, you know, nobody wants to hear that you're retiring. But, you know, you've certainly done more than your share of making some wonderful films. And several of them are among my favorites. And I've added a couple more since preparing, you know. So thanks so much. And I appreciate your sitting with me. Thank you.
It's good talking to you.
Thank you. Can I ask you to do... one thing, and you're not required to do this, but one of the things is I put in the show is I ask sometimes the guest to say, this is John Borman. Mm. They all say, I'm John Borman. It's funny. No, and ask them to say, this is John Borman, the director of Queen and Country and whatever, and you're listening to, and then my show, which I can write down. So it's. Do you mind doing that?
So what would you like me
it's
to
like
do?
Prostituting yourself for a second. You're just basically, it's like an ID thing for my show, and I can put it in once in a while.
Yeah, okay.
Film Wax Radio. So you just say, this is John Borman. I should have written this down beforehand. It's the name of the show is Film Wax, like waxing.
Film Wax.
Waxing philosophical, that kind of That was where it came from.
This is John Borman, and I made Queen and Country, which is playing now, and I'm very glad to be appearing on Film Wax Radio.
Great. Thank you. Perfect one take wonder. All right, that's great. And then I guess, and then I have the course.
You know, there's one thing that, yes. I think it may be pedantic, but.
By all means.
People always talk about the radio programs as their show, whereas the show is the one thing you can't do on radio.
That's true. Now I have to redo. So can you do? You'll have to do another one. No, we didn't say show. So, I have, and then I'm going to clear out.
Right.
I have a copy of Point Blank. Do you mind signing it? Like I have a copy of. Yeah, oh, yeah. Thank you. So in there is a Point Blank and also a marker.
Do you need a Sharpie?
I have one.
Oh, great.
I was mostly prepared today.
Prepared, right?
Yeah. Oh,
great.
Right. Yeah.
See that? Because I think it's moved to the top of my current favorites. I think. Maybe just a picture.
I don't know if your camera is.
I'm putting this up by Monday.
Great.
Because I want to take advantage of week two of film at
that
the film forum.
Fantastic. Can you also link to film forum?
There it is.
Is that what you meant?
Yes.
Okay. You can ask me. I'll do it. Yeah, I would anyway. I hope you enjoyed that. And I hope it also inspired you to go and dig out some of these John Borman films. Most of them are available on Netflix in some form or another. To see the films that we discussed, Hope and Glory is a tough one to get right now. I think it's somewhere out in limbo. But Leo the Last is available through streaming on Netflix. And Deliverance, you can, of course, see probably on all major digital platforms. You can probably see it on, I'm thinking, iTunes and Amazon. And you can definitely rent the discs through Netflix, as you can for Point Blank, Emerald, and Point Blank. You can see Hell in the Pacific. I found a copy in a complete file on YouTube for it. So I don't know how long it'll be up there, but that's how I saw it. It wasn't a great looking copy, but I got to appreciate it through watching it there. And you can also stream The General, not that we talked about it, on Netflix. Zardoz, you can rent the disc through Netflix, and you might be able to see it on other digital platforms as well. That's the mostly what we talked about. So thank you very much, and we'll be back in just a few days with Christopher Allen from Union Docs, he's the founder, and I don't remember his title, like creative, he's like the creative artistic director, I think, or something like that. He'll be on, and he's got his Kickstarter campaign going for their project, which is part of this Kickstarter initiative, so I definitely want to get that up in just a couple of days, and you'll hear probably a few other segments with that. Thank you very much, everybody. This is your host, Adam Chartoff. The name of the show is Film Wax Radio. We're presented by Rooftop Films, and thank you for listening. And don't forget to subscribe and tell everybody you know to subscribe to the podcast, okay? We appreciate it. Thanks so much, everybody. Bye-bye.